So the passage that Pete read to us just now, Psalm 12, that's our passage for tonight. Be very helpful if you've got that in sight. Now, at first glance, you can see as you look down it that it seems to be about truth and deception. Words are spoken. Words can convey truth, but at the same time, words can conceal truth. There's something that's being hidden, and it's amazing how much that theme, we see it all around us in our news, in our art, literature, cinema, and so on. The first lines that came into my head, this is just me, John Bon Jovi, these days, it's gone completely. I didn't write it down. The second line that came into my head is, a few good men, I want the truth, you can't handle the truth. Or those who are of the right age to remember the Mulder and Scully, the X-Files, the truth is out there. And we see that everywhere. Now, recently I got around to reading Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code. Again, that's the theme that runs through that book. There's a truth that's being hidden for those who have eyes to see. You can see signs of it if you're looking in the right place. That's the theme. And one of the things that made my ears prick up in that book is, this is fiction, of course, but one of the things that made my ears pricked up is the claim that all the stories, the Disney reworking of all the old stories, are conveying that hidden truth. So for those who have eyes to see, that thing is being pointed to. And I mean, again, like I say, this is fiction. This is talking about some divine, sacred, feminine thing, but the claim is that it's in those Disney stories, and that's why they're so popular. Now, my favourite Disney thing, which came after the Dan Brown book, is Rapunzel, but the same theme is going on through that story, or Disney's version of it, which is Tangled. There's a truth, but it's hidden away, and if you wanted, you could construct a storyline out of that sort of construct. There's an apparent truth, and then there's a real truth, and there's the revelation of that truth. And basically, that's what happens in the story of Tangled. I won't spoil it completely, but there's an apparent truth that she's the daughter of this mother Gothel living in the tower. There's the real truth that she's the lost princess of the kingdom. And then there's the revelation of that truth. Like I said, I won't spoil it yet. But if you take that statement in verse 4 of our psalm, who is our master, or who is Lord over us, as the New King James has it, you could construct the same sort of plot line around that. There's an apparent truth. We have no Lord over us. We have no master. There's a real truth. We do have a Lord and master. And then there's a revelation of that truth, which we'll get to. So those will be our three points. We'll start with the apparent truth, that we serve no master, we have no Lord over us. The uncomfortable truth that we do have a Lord and Master, and the glorious truth, we are served by our Master. So first of all, the apparent truth. Now before we get to this, we need to say something about the nature of truth itself, going back to Pilate's statement to Jesus. Because our society today has got two basic ways of thinking about truth, two ways of understanding reality, sort of vying to be the main view of society. The first view you see in the world of science and technology, which basically goes something like this. There's no God, or if there is, we can't know him. The only thing you can really be sure about is what you can prove with logic, or what you can taste or touch or hear or see or smell with your senses. There are scientific facts we can learn through science, but not truth, not right and wrong, not purpose in life. I mean, one can think of famous people who were proponents of that view. Bertrand Russell, philosopher from the last century, famous quote of his, "Man is the product of an accidental co-location of atoms. All the noonday brightness of human genius is destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system." That's one way of putting it. Just matter only. Truth, there isn't any, just facts. Start with that, build your life on it, the rest is despair. The second view is radically different, and it goes something like this. We're all God. God is everything. Here's how you find truth. You get in touch with the fact that we are divinity, we are radiance, we are perfection, part of everything. We are God. Truth means going into yourself, new states of consciousness, so we become part of this glorious reality. Not something outside, but something that's inside, something subjective. Again, proponents of this view, people like Shirley MacLaine, Oprah Winfrey, Beverly Golje wrote this. Once we begin to see that we are all God, that we all have attributes of God, then I think the whole purpose of human life is to re-own the God-likeness within. Very different, but everything not based on the Bible tends to head towards one of those two ways of seeing things. But there's a problem. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard wrote a book a long time ago, The Sickness Unto Death, it was called. And in that book, he pointed out that everybody is seeking to establish a sense of self by making something central to our significance, purpose, and happiness. And there are a million ways of doing this. Here are a couple of examples. In the film Rocky, Rocky's partner, Adrienne, asks him why he's putting himself through this torture. And he says he wants to go the distance so he'll know he's not a bum. The guy from Chariots of Fire, was it Harold Abrams, said he had 10 lonely seconds to justify his existence. You see, those two, they're looking to athletic achievement for their sense of worth. Another writer who wrote about this much more recently said a child's need for self-worth is the condition of his life. He called it cosmic significance. Our need for worth is so powerful that whatever we base our identity and value on, we essentially deify. We look to it with all the passion and intensity of worship, even if we're not remotely religious. That was Ernest Becker. You see, we deify it, we serve it, whatever it is. Everyone must find some way to justify their existence, as Harold Abrams had it, and prove they're not a bum. Now, this psalm's got some examples of those things that you might look to. For example, in verse 2, we see people looking for approval, human approval. Or in verse 3, it's more about status, fulfilling duties to family or giving service to society. Or in verse 4, we will triumph. There it's more about gaining and wielding power. You see, these are things to be served. They promise to give us meaning and purpose in life, to justify our existence, but there's a problem. And whatever these things are, there's a couple of things you have to realize about them. First of all, they cannot deliver what they promise to deliver. Secondly, you will always be anxious about the loss of them, whatever it is, because if it's threatened, your very self is threatened. And thirdly, because of that, they will introduce some sort of brokenness into your life and into the lives of others. And in fact, whatever particular thing it is, there'll be different sorts of brokenness. So for example, verse 5 of the psalm talks about oppression and injustice. And that's either because people are serving power and they've unjustly treated those who are in the way, or perhaps people are serving their own comfort and they fail to help when they could have done, or perhaps people are serving human approval and they fail to speak up against some injustice when they had the opportunity. But if it's, for example, human approval that you're serving, then you'll be in trouble because you'll be constantly hurt by criticism, you'll be losing friends, and you'll fear the confrontation that comes when you try to pull people up. And so you'll be a useless friend anyway. Or it could be, for example, family and children. If you make that the center of your life, you try to live life through them until they end up resenting you or they have no self of their own. If it's work and career, for example, then you'll become a workaholic, a boring, shallow person. And if your career goes badly, well then, you'll become depressed and so on. Or if it's money and possessions, then you'll be eaten up by worry and jealousy about money, perhaps even doing unethical things to maintain your lifestyle. Or if it's pleasure and comfort that you're serving, you become addicted to something and you'll be chained to whatever the escape strategies are that you're using to avoid the hardness of life. And it could even be something that's very good in itself. It could be some noble cause. But in that case, you divide the world into good and bad and you demonize your opponents. It could even be, dare I say it, religion and morality. in which case, if you live up to your moral standards, then you become proud and self-righteous. And if you fail to live up to your standards, then you become consumed by guilt and anxiety, and so on. So whatever this thing is, it will inevitably let us down if you're serving it. And the reason for that is, there is a God who demands our service. There is a God who demands our service, and that is the uncomfortable truth. Now, those two views of truth that I started with, we might call them empiricism, the scientific view, and pantheism, the notion that God is everything. Although they look at first value very different, they've got one thing in common that's very important. You see, if you hold to one of those two views, when you get up in the morning tomorrow, you have nothing to obey. It doesn't actually require you to behave in any particular way. You're still free to do as you like. Now, the truth the Bible talks about is not like that. It comes from outside. It's categorical. It's hard copy. And it requires submission because it's truth that's spoken by the Lord. This is the Lord, L-O-R-D, in capitals. And the New King James points up the contrast by having verse 4 as Lord, L-O-R-D, in small letters. You see, we're talking here about the God of the universe, L-O-R-D in capitals, his title, which comes five times in the psalm. Now, the psalm doesn't explicitly say there is a God in the universe. It just uses his title five times, assuming that we know he's there. And that's actually not an unreasonable thing to do. In Tim Keller's book, The Reason for God, he's got a chapter in which he basically doesn't argue that they're for the existence of God, but rather he claims everybody already knows there is a God. You see, he says, he talks about the notion of moral obligation. We all know there are things we ought to do and there are things ways in which we ought to behave, and humanity is basically agreed about them. But the problem is, where do they come from? If there's no God, there's no way to say one thing is moral and one thing is immoral, but only I like doing this. And that question, who is our master or who is our Lord, or as one writer had it, says who, wrote, if there's no God, then all moral statements are subjective and internal. There's no external moral standard by which a person's feelings and values are judged. That writer ends his essay like this: as things are now, everything is up for grabs. Nevertheless, napalming babies is bad. Starving the poor is wicked. Buying and selling each other is depraved. There is such a thing as evil. Altogether now, says who? God help us. If you believe human rights are a reality, then it makes much more sense that God exists than that he doesn't. If you continue to insist on the secular view of the world, you just can't pronounce some things good and some things bad with any integrity. In that essay, Arthur Leff was the writer. When he says everything is up for grabs, one thinks, for example, of the current marriage debate. Without objective truth from the Lord and his word being spoken up into that situation, who says marriage is this or that? Who says two men can't get married, or two women, or even three people, as it's currently being debated in Brazil, I think it is? You see, the uncomfortable truth is that God demands our service. And not only do we fail to serve, but we put other things in God's place and we serve them instead, thinking that they will treat us better than God, thinking that they are less demanding than God. The objective truth is that God is. He demands our service. We have not given it. We have rebelled. We have served something else. We've assumed that those other things have more interest in us than God has, and that God was really trying to hold us back. This is what the Bible calls sin. And the sin underneath all sins is to decide that we know better than God what is good for us, that we have something better to serve than him, and that we know we have offended God by doing this, and so we have to hide this truth from ourselves. Now, there's lots of ways of hiding this knowledge. One can think of several examples. We use the language of psychology, for example. We give it a different name. We don't call it sin. The passage that we studied this morning in Romans 1, a little bit further on, has it like this: we suppress the knowledge that we have a God and that we've offended him. In verse 2, the NIV has the word deception, and the older English versions have that as a double heart. And the Hebrew literally is a heart and a heart. Now, my normal work is congenital heart disease, and we see lots of weird and wonderful things. Two right atria, two left atria, double lytic ventricle, double aortic arch. But there's no such thing as a double heart. It doesn't exist. What the Bible's talking about here is a psychological phenomenon, repression. You can hide something away and almost forget about it. There are other ways to hide this truth. For example, anyone here, I'm sure there are some here who were born between about 1980 and the year 2000. You would call yourselves the millennial generation or Generation Y, say early 20s to early 30s thereabouts. Your generation is different from all previous generations in that you're more confident and entitled and assertive than any previous generation. You've had your self-esteem systematically stoked. You've had this unique specialness drummed into you from your upbringing. If you're in this part of the world, the pursuit of your dreams, you're a person of worth and you can contribute to society and so on, it is drummed into you. That may be very well as far as it goes. But there's a downside of that, which is that it's harder for you to admit that there's something wrong with you when a problem comes into your life than it is for somebody of a previous generation. And the uncomfortable truth is there is something radically wrong with all of us that we have to admit. And of course, then, there's the whole world of entertainment, which grows and grows and grows, and it's possible to distract ourselves endlessly and hide away this uncomfortable truth. But when God speaks, and incidentally in this psalm, this is the first time that God's words are actually spoken by God in this psalm. When God speaks, then we do well to sit up and listen to see what God says about this. Now, verse 6 says, "The words of the Lord are flawless." And we have to ask ourselves, what is meant by the words of the Lord? Now, if you take that literally, then the words of the Lord were those words that were spoken through God to his people, largely through the prophets. And they essentially fall into two categories, words of love and words of judgment. That was essentially what the prophets were telling the people. So words of the Lord is going to revolve around those two themes. Now, God speaking love, we get that. We can understand that pretty well. But words of judgment starts to get a little bit more difficult. God says, in verse 5, "I will protect them." Now, the question that should immediately be raised in our minds is, how on earth can God protect us from the judgment that must surely be coming our way if we have rebelled against him? We see the furnace spoken of in verse 6, like silver refined in a furnace of clay. And really, if we have failed to give God true allegiance and he is our real master, then really any judgment in a furnace should have us in it by rights. Now, the furnace, when you see a furnace spoken of in the Bible, it's talking about judgment, but judgment with a particular aim in mind. So one thinks of the Israelites when they were in Egypt or Babylon. They were described as being in the furnace of affliction. I think that's Isaiah 48. There, it's not just about judgment, but it's about leaving something that's pure in there as well, as you would do with a metal. Silver, it comes in the psalm, if you wanted to purify it. Now, centuries later, when the Bible writers wrote about Jesus, they called him the Word, or the Logos, as it was in Greek. And by the time they wrote that, Logos had become a philosophically loaded term, because for hundreds of years before that, the Greek philosophers had been after what they knew as the Logos, a truth or a principle or a reason for everything, the meaning of life, if you like, the one thing that makes sense of everything. They'd been arguing about it for hundreds of years. And actually, by the time that Jesus came, they'd basically given up looking for it. So when the Bible writers talk about the Word or the Logos of God having come, that was a bombshell, because they were declaring, "We found the Logos that you've been looking for." And what was it? Not just a word that God spoke, but a person God sent. Not just someone who has the truth, but someone who is the truth. Talking about Jesus Christ, of course. And how does Jesus Christ show us the words of the Lord purified seven times. God's words of love and of judgment purified seven times. We see that pointing forward to what Jesus did on the cross, the most eloquent expression of the love and judgment of God. He went into the furnace himself. He endured the judgment of God on our behalf, in our place. He was substituted for us. He goes himself into the furnace of God's judgment. At the very last moment of his life, almost, he speaks some shocking words. My God, why have you forsaken me? And he said those words so that we don't have to. That is what Christians mean by the gospel. Now, going back to Rapunzel, I've said to you that Dan Brown, in his Da Vinci Code book, said that the reason those Disney stories mean so much to us is that they're pointing to a sort of very important truth, if you like. And that's the reason we can't get enough of them. They're connecting to some sort of deeper story. That's actually partly true, because those old Disney stories, Grimm fairy tales and so on, they are pointing to a deeper truth, but it's nothing to do with some divine sacred feminine, as the Da Vinci Code claims. It's the truth about ourselves and our plight as rebels against our true master. It's the truth about our rescuer. You see, in those stories, the true prince comes and he rescues the maiden. The maiden is, of course, us. It's humanity, and the rescuer is Jesus Christ, the hero. You see, Rapunzel had the truth hidden from her for her whole life. She's been deliberately deceived about her true self. She's got inklings of the truth. She sees these lanterns in the sky. She's told they're stars, but she doesn't really believe that, or at least she suspects something. And her revelation comes, I hate to spoil this, but her revelation comes in two stages. She sees the lanterns for real in the sky, and she's blown away by the wonder and the grandeur of this amazing sight. Later, she thinks about it at home alone, and she realizes the truth. This was all about her. This was for her. It was done for her benefit. It's about who she really is, not Mother Gothel's daughter locked up in a tower, but the true princess. She realizes who she really is. She finds her true identity. So we see Jesus on the cross. Surely we see our true identity as his servants. Surely we say, what master could be better to serve than one who dies in the place of his servants to save their lives? Surely when we see that, we say, how could we not serve that master? What are we doing serving any other master? No other master would die for us. No other master can save us. Surely now we understand Jesus' words in Matthew 11. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So if we wanted to engage in the psalm in a more practical way, there are a couple of ways we could do that. And by the way, two things about this. First of all, if you're thinking about this for the very first time, if you're thinking for the first time about the fact that you've been serving other masters and not the true master, or if you've been on this road a long time, and ask anyone who's been a Christian for any length of time, and they'll tell you that constantly these other things tempt us away. They tempt us to serve them, and we take our allegiance away from the true God. In order to continue in the Christian life, we do the same thing as we do when we first start. We transfer our allegiance totally to the true master. So I'm speaking as much to people who are thinking about this for the first time as people who have been doing this for a long time. And secondly, these three things I would pull out line up quite nicely with the things that David Higham gave us this morning when we did Romans 1. So we could apply it like this. First of all, the very first word of the psalm is help. Now, we love to recommend ourselves to God with something we think we've done in his service. But very often when we do that, it's some other God that we're serving. Perhaps it's our social status or our need for approval, and that will offend God. For example, we do some good deed in our church or for our community or whatever, and all the time we're really serving ourselves, our self-righteousness, or we're looking for approval of so on. Now, of course, such deeds of service are good, but only out of gratitude for what he's already done for us, not in order to commend ourselves to him. All we can do is to cry out for help, as the first word of the psalm has it. You see, we continue to be taken in, if we're Christian believers, by the promises of other gods and by the untruth that God's service is harsh and by the untruth that these other things will provide us with what we think we need if only we'll serve them. So we cry out for help, prayer, individually, corporately, as David said this morning. Secondly, God's service does indeed require us to work. I say again, not to commend ourselves to God to try and earn favor. That's only ever serving some other God. But how do you think God deals with oppression and injustice? This is what Keller's book is about. Jesus' death was not just about personal salvation and forgiveness, although it is that, but the service God demands of you requires you to deal with oppression and injustice in community with other believers. God doesn't just magic that away. He expects his followers to engage in that work. And heaven, in fact, is about the perfection of this world and the removal of injustice and oppression. But God expects his people engaging in works of service to take part in that work for now. So the oppression of the weak and the groaning of the needy, Christian believers are called to take part in that work here and now in deeds of service. Thirdly, in community, even if the voice that speaks in the first half of the psalm is a lone voice, it's clear from verse 7 that he's speaking on behalf of a community. And that's very important in God's service, just as salvation is not just a personal individual affair, although it is that. God is interested in communities, and that's why his followers are organized into communities, or churches, as the Bible calls them. And David Higham's third point this morning summarized that very, very nicely, community. So cry out for help. We do works of service and community. Now, if we allow ourselves to be rescued, if we give ourselves in service to the true master, if we consciously replace whatever gods we've been serving with the true master by crying out for help, by engaging in his work in community with his other servants, then we'll find our true identity. What could convince us that this master is better than the sight of him going into the furnace for us? No other master, however noble or worthy, is going to do that for us. So if you're not a Christian believer here tonight, won't you acknowledge that you've been serving other masters and that you've failed the true master? Won't you gratefully receive his rescue and find your true identity as his servant, the master who knows your needs best because he created you? And if you are a Christian here tonight, won't you rededicate yourself to his service? Marvel again at how your master served your needs by taking your place, and rededicate yourself to his service by crying out to him, re-engaging in his work in the world, in service to him and in community with his people.